Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the debut show of the Griffin Chronicles on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Denny Griffin, and for the next hour, I will be your co-host for tonight's show. And joining me, my sidekick, Delilah Jones. Delilah, welcome back, or not back to, this is the first show of the Griffin Chronicles. Thanks for being with me.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me, Denny. It's always a pleasure.
And we have a very, I think, excellent guest to kick off the Griffin Chronicles with tonight. And the name of the guest is Dawn Schiller. And Dawn was 15 years old when she met 32-year-old porn star John Holmes in 1976. Holmes courted Dawn, had sex with her, manipulated her with drugs and alcohol, and ultimately physically and emotionally abused her for several years. After the famed Wonderland murders in 1981, the two fled to Florida, where Dawn ultimately broke free and turned John over to the police. And Dawn has a book coming out shortly that we'll talk about, her memoir called The Road Through Wonderland. It's slated for national release, in fact, this August by Medallion Press. Dawn, welcome to the Griffin Chronicles.
Thank you very much, Denny. It's nice to be here, and your sidekick, Delilah, as well. Hello, Delilah.
Hi, Dawn.
Now, what I'd like to do is, if you would, Dawn, give us the listeners, please, just I just did a brief, obviously there's a lot more to your story than what I read. Would you want to give us a little bit more of the history of what happened to you and with Mr. Holmes and so forth, and then we'll have some questions for you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, loaded question, Denny. It's not a short answer, I can tell you that. like you read in the brief intro there, when I was 15 years old, I ran into John Holmes. But the story doesn't really start there. You mentioned the book, The Road Through Wonderland, that I wrote about my experience, and then there's just a whole bigger world than just running into John at 15. I like to talk about, the circumstances and the predicament I was in when I was younger than that and how I ended up being on the doorstep of John Holmes outside of the porn industry in 1976. At 15 years old, with just my father and my sister and myself coming across from Florida. I talk about that in my book. I think really what I talk about, too, is, the detailed history of how John was able to come into my life and how my background set me up for that kind of experience. So it is a story of being abused and John as a predator.
And Dawn, when you talk about, your early childhood and so forth, maybe the listeners would want to know, how was it growing up in your family? I mean, obviously you got up and went to school and did all of those things, but how was the interaction within your family with your parents and with, your siblings?
The interaction with my family was extremely broken and disjointed, and I relate to what I call being a throwaway child, and I'll talk about that hopefully later in this program, but I consider a throwaway child a child that was going through abuse and neglect, and there was a lot of neglect. There was verbal abuse. There was abandonment. My mother was very a tough cookie who was abandoned by my father as well as we were, when he took off for 7 years, and we were in a rough neighborhood in Florida, and he showed up and divorced her, and took us across town. But by that time, I was really a kid who was trying to escape getting beat up all the time off the streets, in the home. Mother wasn't there. She was working three jobs. You know, bless her for doing that, really. I have great respect for her strength in that respect. She had it tough. She had it tough. But she was tough on us. And so when you grow up in that kind of environment, you really, you know, you don't see that the world is setting you up to walk straight for somebody who is going to seek that kind of thing out as a vulnerability. And that's how I see my growing up in my family. I had certain people, my great-grandmother and my great-aunt, who were dear to me. You know, and as every child will look for the good and the gold and the love in their life, and they will, you know, no matter if the family is broken or what, they're going to love and they're going to be attached to that family. So I hope that I express that in my book well enough that a lot of people will understand that, you know, everybody grew up in a home where we know, where we're looking for love, we look for that support, we look for that, you know, emotional support, physical support, you know, the house and the food. And we really were struggling. It was a struggling family with a lot of abuse and abandonment. So that's my background.
And so you and your sister traveled across from Florida clear to California. And when you got there, you really had nowhere to stay. You were staying with, what was it, friends of someone that you picked up along the way?
Yeah, I want to leave some stuff for when anybody wants to read the book. So I will say that, you know, it, because of the whole circumstances with being abandoned and divorced and having to be pulled apart, that we ended up at the apartment complex where John Holmes was the manager with his wife outside of the porn industry, and they were the building managers. John was 32 years old. This was 1976. I was 15. And
so he kind of had a double life going on there with the porn industry and then, you know, in the complex there that he managed with his wife.
Right, absolutely. He had quite the double life. You know, I think.
Did you know about it when you met him first? I mean,
No.
Was it something that you didn't know at all that he was in that industry?
You know, it was revealed to me by one of the tenants there, and I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what it was, but John had no reason to go after me other than I was really not looked out for. He buddied up to my father, who was disabled and a pot smoker, and became his dealer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so he diverted my father's attention by being his friend, and took a liking or a shine to me. And it wasn't necessary. You know, I was talking to Delilah earlier a little bit today to just kind of roughly go over what the show is about, because I've never done one of these, And we talked about how, you know, John was at the top of his porn business career and had no reason to go after somebody like me, other than the fact that he was a pedophile. And, you know, I don't...
Can you go
sorry
into
to
a
all
little...
those...
Mm-hmm. No, I'm sorry, John. Can you go into a little bit about the grooming process? Because I think... You know, I don't know what people know about your situation back then, but I know it before I read the book anyway, it was kind of like, how on earth could something like this possibly happen? But then after I read it and after, you know, I read it through, put myself in your shoes, yeah, I can see definitely how this can happen. And can you go a little bit about how John came on to you and how he... provided what you needed.
Mm-hmm. Well, like I said, we came from a needy, dysfunctional group, just limping along, and who ended up in his courtyard that he managed. And we were short on food. My father had a disability. He was also a pot smoker with John, and John liked to be the guy to come in and have the bag, you know, and he would you know, share it with my dad or, you know, help my father. He would bring us food. You know, he did the classic grooming process. And I really like what you said, Delilah, about when you read the book, that you walk in my shoes. And before you read the book, you don't understand how could this happen. It's just too bizarre. It's too bizarre a story. And the truth is, it isn't so bizarre. The only reason you're hearing about mine is because my batterer, my predator, was John Holmes.
That's
Many
right.
other young girls are being groomed by somebody similar to him, but they don't have a name that
That's
gets
right.
any attention. And they don't get a voice like I've been given this opportunity to have this voice and get this story out there in the voice of a young girl who doesn't come from a home that has the perfect support system or love or, you know, caring that every child deserves, and how that left me open and vulnerable to fall for somebody who is a predator. And as you read the book, you see all of the seduction techniques that he used. I mean, he was the master, according to all the porn people, you know, he was the master. I was surrounded by adults. This is another one of my highlights that I point out to people. And as I'm telling the story, you go, why didn't that person say anything? Why didn't that person say anything? He charmed them all. And that's what they do. That's what a predator does. And somebody like John would have been easily charmed, anyone, and he did. He also reached out to me. I mean, he knew I had never seen a lot of kindness in my life. He knew that I had never seen, you know, anything special, or I never was anything special. He gave me that in increments, enough to make me feel this connection with him and what I thought was love. And it's actually seduction because it is a grooming process. It's a targeted grooming process. You know, he started waking me up for school every morning. Now, what business was it of his to wake me up? Nobody's. Did anybody say anything? No.
But back then, you didn't realize that that was inappropriate.
No, I saw adults around me not making any comment, and so I flowed with that. I mean, they're the to me, I look back and I say, you guys should have told me, you know. I really feel as though when you're around an adult who should do something or say something, that if they don't, I felt like I was being laid out for slaughter.
And I think one thing, too, I don't think most people realize is that John was married.
John was married. His wife lived with him in that same, you know, cottage apartment complex. And, again, she was somebody who I was told they only lived like brother and sister because this is what he did for a living. Well, I didn't know what that living really, I didn't understand it. And later on in the book, I go through how he seduced me, how he gained everybody's trust, and how, you know, he was able to make me his. Look back, and I was telling you, too, this morning, Delilah, that when I look back and I'm editing the pages for my book, and I look back and I read, again, all the parts where I mention how much I feel like I love him, and I feel so close, and he's being so kind and warm, and I really just want to be sick. Because it's, I know better now, you know, and I wish that wasn't true, but it's really important for me to keep that there and share that with public because that is what you're thinking. That is what a child is experiencing, those thoughts, those strong emotional thoughts of connecting to the predator are actually really happening, and you need to understand that, you know, that's pretty powerful.
Well, and they tend to isolate you, kind of like that. What is it, like the Stockholm Syndrome where, you know, when you're held captive and you, you know, you become friendly with the captor, the person that's actually harming you and isolating you.
Mm-hmm. Actually, yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, what else did I have? I had John on the one hand saying, here, I know you need food and clothing and, you know, a stuffed animal and, you know, to feel like you're cared for and wanted and loved. And on the other hand, for that, I want something from you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm going to be a good person on this side, but you've got it. But this is what I expect from you on the other side. And we have to hide this, and it's a secret, and nobody, and we don't talk about it.
No.
And nobody needs to know about you.
So he did. He kept you secret for quite a long time.
Oh, sure. My family was definitely, slowly but surely, not allowed to be a part of my world. And as you read the book, you'll see the circumstances that separate me from my family. And I think then the picture becomes a little more clear.
Ladies, can I interrupt just a second? I would like to give out our phone number in case anybody listening has a question or comment for Dawn. You can reach us at 646-478-0982. 646-478-0982. And Dawn, a few minutes ago you were talking about throwaway teens. And you actually developed a presentation called Our Throwaway Teens, Who Are They and How Can We Help? And you present that nationally, am I correct?
Yes, you're absolutely correct. I'm very, very excited to, while writing the book and doing, you know, I'm sober for many years, obviously, and you're going to see a lot of drug action and, you know, in the book, and so you're going to want to know how's that going with me. Sober for many years, a lot of counseling, a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder counseling specifically, and then a lot of advocacy work. I started off as a volunteer hotline at our shelter, and then I'm in my third year now as a board member for Shelter from the Storm, which is my local shelter. I'm also affiliated with Eastern Oregon University, and I am a student there. So I'm a gender studies minor student, and I, in the last year and a half, have been doing all the, you know, the hardcore research for the statistics on what I was going through. You know, I could write my story. I wrote the book. It was in the editing process with the publisher, but in this year past plus, I still wanted to put together something to raise awareness and educate people, not only from my story and showing you what it was like to go through that experience, but to couple it with statistics and research and what's going on today. And so I did develop a presentation, and I do take it around locally and nationally. It's called, like you said, Our Throwaway Teens, Who Are They and How Can We Help? And it describes what a throwaway teen is. It describes the, you know, the legislature that came out of Washington, D.C. in 1977 that actually gave us the term throwaway because they couldn't figure out any other, there had to be another reason that kids were going on the street other than just running away. There had to be another reason. So they gave them the term throwaway, and that's when they're forced out. But what I claim is that a throwaway can also live in the home, and that's a lot of times how I felt. I was in the home of, you know, in a home where there was a lot of abuse and neglect, and I wasn't getting the basic needs that every child deserves. So when you were raised in that circumstance, you are so vulnerable and more susceptible to, you know, just a host of different things, and definitely one of them being sexual predator. For me, that's what happened to me, drugs and alcohol, crime, you know, incarceration, a lot of other things, throwaways can end up happening to them. And
Think that there's a definite link between throwaways, runaways, and missing children, human trafficking of young teens and young children? How do you feel about that?
Oh, I'm absolutely on board with that. That's a huge key. I mean, you know, you're harvested when you're homeless. There, predators are out there, and they're looking for those throwaways who have run away. And a throwaway is also someone who runs away because it becomes too horrible to be at home, or they've just been abandoned. You know, they've abandoned, and the parents go, well, you know, you're old enough. I don't have enough to take care of you. You know, go for it.
So what do you think, as far as legislation and you know, maybe how our government and law enforcement officials look at this is maybe how it's reported. Is it really, are these cases really being reported correctly?
No, they're not. They're severely underreported. One of the things that I discovered in my research is that they were so underreported. I knew better. I mean, I just can look around and I can tell. And because I came from that, you know, John trafficked me. So that would, you know, and that's part of the book, too. Eventually that happens, you know. It happens. And when I was, you know, there was others around. And I saw them on the streets, and I saw them at places. And, you know, terrible, terrible. It's not gone away. But anyway, I lost my train of thought. Sorry.
We have a caller on the line. Why don't I get the caller?
Okay.
We'll see what question
we have. Sure.
111, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
I want to commend you, Dawn. I think what you're doing is wonderful. And it's very important. And I think that what you've done is the basis for really laying the groundwork for people to really understand the human trafficking element. Even though this is in the 70s, it's so prevalent today because of the internet, because of the throwaway kids. And people don't understand that. This isn't just some story you've written. This isn't really about your life. This really depicts what children are going through now in the present day that people are trying to figure out as these human trafficking bureaus are being formed across the country now in police departments. You need to connect with them because it's not your story, it's not John Holmes, it's what happened to you and how it happened so that they can see that these children are being taken, and a lot of them are being taken out of the country.
Absolutely, absolutely. You're 100% right. Thank you, and it's nice to meet you. I just applaud you for that because I do believe that I was only given this voice to put the story out for others, you know, and John... You know, in his
John
grave,
is a conduit. And he didn't make you who you are.
Yeah.
You had
no.
to take from what took place. And that's what, I know I sound familiar. This is Susan Murphy Milano.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I've heard of you, but hi.
Hi. And I was so thrilled that you were going to be on the show because...
Wonderful.
You're not just, like I said, this isn't just some story that some lady wrote. This really depicts a lot of the victims that we read about that we can't find, that are missing. This is what this is about. And you do have an opportunity to deal with these bureaus that are being formed, to get in there, to really start something that no one understands. They don't understand this. This is a whole new territory.
Exactly. It's very new. I was just at the Northwest Conference Against Trafficking here in Portland, Oregon, 2 weekends ago, and they're just now opening legislation. They're just now beginning on human trafficking, and you're right. It seems to be a real mystery, dark spot nobody really wants to talk about. But I am there for these kids who didn't have a voice. I speak, and I wrote it in the voice of how I was feeling, regardless of how embarrassed I am looking at that dialogue and those thought processes, because this is what everybody's thinking. These are what these kids are thinking.
Now,
and I'm
now it's 30 years later, so now you're close to half a century. So how different is your mindset now, looking back on everything that took place today as regards to everything that you do every day, your relationships, your interactions with other people? Do you think that you're more forgiving, more understanding? Do you think that you might be more hardened by what happened, less trusting?
I went through all of those emotions. I don't want to be anything that isn't, you know, as normal as possible, and there's no real, you know, screw on normal around here, you know, on this planet. I just want to be okay. And so my fears are not overwhelming fears that suffocate and hurt me anymore, but they used to be. You know, I had to go through, you know, getting through triggers. I had to go through terrible addiction. I had to go through, you know, getting on the other side of that. I had to unlearn.
You had to get out of the dark.
I had to get out of the dark. I had to unlearn all those things that I still, and this is another huge thing. When you're seduced at such a young age and you're never given the proper love and you're told this is love but it's abusive, you have to unlearn that. That is a hard thing to get rid of. That's very difficult.
Programming that if somebody doesn't help you through it, you're not going to do it.
No. You got to unlearn. You got to tell yourself that's not love. Love is this. And so, you know, I have a daughter now. I have a 10-year-old daughter. And so I have to walk my talk. I have to walk my talk. So if I'm,
but it's hard.
If I'm not,
it's hard, though, isn't it?
It's hard for everyone. It's hard for everyone. So I don't feel too much pressure to be perfect.
I commend you. I'm not trying to take over the show. I just called in. I just thought, you're doing a hell of a job. And really, the human trafficking is probably the area you need to focus on most to really get the word out there. So good luck to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Susan.
And I totally agree. I think, like you were saying earlier, there's not a lot of states that have human trafficking laws, and the ones that do have them, they are not enforced and they're not reported as human trafficking. So many times it's reported, and the young girl may be arrested for prostitution. And
absolutely.
Therefore the resources aren't available for her to be helped.
Mm-hmm.
So we're throwing her away again.
we're throwing her away again. And, gosh, yes, it is. We do need to learn from our mistakes, though, as a community and as a public service, you know, for these throwaways. We need to get shelters. We need to get proper counseling for them. It's really a tough thing to have been trafficked. It's really a tough thing to have gotten over. Do you ever? I don't know. You know, I have my worries every now and then, but I live with it, you know. I think...
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm okay. There's nothing bad's going to happen to me over my worries. But, you know, I have good tools. I have a good support system. I surround myself with good people. I've had, like I said, lots of counseling, and, you know, and I'm clean and sober. And I really recommend, I mean, those things are difficult things to achieve. It's taken a long time to get here.
But one at a time. One thing in itself is hard to overcome. With every, you know, each thing that you have had to overcome it's just mind-boggling.
Well, but you can do it. See, and if I'm standing here saying you can do it, you can do it. And that's what I want people to know. It's as tough as it can be. If you're in a bad situation, don't give up. You can do it.
That's right. There's always hope.
Yes, yes. And I also, you know, I also talk about in my presentation some of the solutions, and I really like to educate some of our teens, our other teens that are not throwaways, because peers helping peers is a huge resource, a huge resource that we need to tap into. I also believe in mentoring, in community mentoring. And I have an amazing, I have to put a shout out to Medallion Press. I love you guys. You're amazing. They've supported me with this story. They are not exploitive. They are definitely their heart, and Helen Rosberg, who's the CEO of Medallion Press, her heart is in to get helping others and putting it out there for that purpose of helping, you know, the next young girl who may fall and prey or victim or family who doesn't know what's going on with people.
And that's
they love.
Really good to know. It's good to know that a corporation or a company, you know, would be that supportive of the issue. You know, yes, you as their author, but the issue in itself, I think that really speaks very highly of them.
Mm-hmm. I have to say it. I have to say it wherever I go. You know, they have completely, you know, this could have gone, you know, with John's name attached. I've had other stories completely go left, completely south. You know, it's gone, you know, where was my interview? Where was the part where I was being abused? They don't. You know, a lot of times interviews were taken and they were twisted around to say, well, you know, like she let him beat her. And I've never heard of anybody letting somebody get beat before. But I've actually seen interviews written where that's how they filled in the gaps.
What do you say to the people that are reading the book and they're reading about all of the things that you've been through and they go, well, why didn't she just leave?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you know anything about domestic violence, if you know anything about abuse, it's the most dangerous point in being in an abusive relationship. It's the most dangerous time you could have if you try to leave. When you leave, you are at the highest risk of being killed or severely hurt. And in my book, you will see I was ultimately pushed to the corner, to the edge so many times that I tried to leave in several different ways and several times. But for many reasons was brought back by the police once. I tried to commit suicide. You know, and I was telling you too, Delilah, so many horrific things happened and abuse happened that nobody knows about or the media has not really wanted to shine a light on because it is John Holmes and they want to protect that part of the story more.
And I find that surprising, you know. I find it very surprising. I mean, for one thing, the industry he was in, the other thing, he's no longer with us. I mean, what's left to protect?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well,
there's
I don't
not
really
an image
know
there.
Well, it, you know, apparently to some people there's an iconic image and he needs, you know, of something. And it wasn't anything I understood because I understood a completely different person that really, you know, that was self-serving and vicious and cruel in the end. And so, you know, therefore the Wonderland murders. And I know, you know, he left a lot of tragedy and pain and suffering wherever he went in the, you know, in the years that I knew him. What he did afterwards, I don't know. I don't know, you know. And I'm glad I didn't, but apparently, you know, I understand that he did contract AIDS about 4 years after, 3 or 4 years after I'd run from him and then he eventually passed away from the disease. So.
Do you want to go into the murders and how that all came about?
I think that that's, I mean, I can a little bit, I suppose, that, you know, as he was being abusive and as he was trafficking me, he also got himself into involved with, you know, a drug lord by the name of Eddie Nash, who he ended up owing money to, and he hung out with the Wonderland Gang, a group of people who were thieves and drug dealers themselves, apparently. And I would wait outside of the house several days because he wouldn't let me go in. He wouldn't let me go in there. If, you know, if there wasn't the big retaliation and the murders in that house, eventually he may have let me go in there. I don't know. He was probably on that path, but he did.
You feel
take
he was being
up.
Protective of you?
I feel that I was no. You know, when I look back on it, I think he. He said some terrible things about the people in that house. And I really, I don't want to repeat, you know, I want to
right.
be respectful to any of their family members that are maybe listening
right.
Or their friends, because they lost loved ones in this tragedy too. And, you know, but he was not kind about, you know, the people in there. It was the pot calling the kettle black, you know, when I look back. But I think that... He may have been protecting me at some point, but I also think that I was his ace in the hole because he played people like cards,
right?
Like a poker game. Now, I hope this is making sense to the listeners and we're not being too elusive, but eventually I'll go back. Eventually he was involved with a plot to rip off Eddie Nash with the Wonderland Gang, and Eddie Nash allegedly retaliated. And John went into the house, let them into the house, the murderers into the house, and four of the people five people in the house were bludgeoned to death. And those are known as the Wonderland murders, the Los Angeles Wonderland murders, also known as the four on the floor, apparently.
Right. And then you and John left there.
Yes, I was waiting for him down the street when it happened. And he arrived back at the motel room, and from then on, it was a big police kind of a chase. It was arrests, protective custody, and then we were released and let go and on the run from the FBI, and we traveled across country being fugitives from the FBI, and you know, and it eventually ended in Florida, where through the intervention of some people who he made the mistake of battering me in front of, they actually took a stand and got me out of there.
Thank God for them.
Thank God for them. Really, yeah. I probably would have never been able to get away otherwise. But back to your question about why didn't I leave? I tried, and it was the time where he almost killed me even more. But I was pushed to the limit of trying. And really, when I tried to commit suicide, that was me trying to leave again.
Oh, certainly. It's, you know, it becomes so painful that you feel like that is the only way out, because, you know, your planning process isn't working. All the plans that you have in the back of your mind and you're trying to implement, they're not working.
Right. Right. Well, and you're trapped and you're isolated, and you feel as though you're in a corner and there is no other way. There's no
right.
other way, you know, except to leave your body, because you just need to.
Mm-hmm. And do you want to go into what did you do with your life after you turned him in?
Well, a little bit, I think. I think I still need to write that story, because it's you don't get better. And I think, Delilah, we were talking about it today.
Mm-hmm.
Just because you're removed from the physical situation doesn't mean that you're well or you're not still bleeding internally and emotionally,
right.
psychologically. I got away. I was in hiding in Southeast Asia, and again with my father, and really was. Again, not misguided, misled. You know, I think I floundered. I call it floundering over there. I was, I ran into a lot of trouble, a lot of bad people. You know, some good people, some not so good. But I was alone and desperate and just broken. And I used alcohol to really numb out a lot of things. asking them about a lot of things.
What age were you when you were in Asia?
I was 21 till I was 27, just about.
Mm-hmm. So still, even at that time in your life, you still needed the guidance of someone because you were never given that in your childhood.
No. And when you're not, you mean... No, you didn't get it. So, I came back to the States and really I in 86, 87, and, a lot of other things happened. I really was searching for my spirit. I was searching for, I had found some hope in faith, but I still needed a lot of counseling, and I needed to understand that drinking was debilitating for me, and I needed to step back from that, that it had already become, it was a big problem. In 1988, I went back down to LA, and that was the year that John died. And I wanted to tell him, I'm better than what you ever told me. I made it. You thought I couldn't make it. You thought I was nothing, and you thought, in the end, he was very verbally and physically abusive. And so, I really wanted to show him. And
right.
And he passed away just about a few weeks after I got into LA. And I don't want to talk about, but I did have an encounter with him. And I think, Delilah, you read the book, so you know what I'm talking about. But I don't
yeah.
want to give that away because I think that, I think that that's kind of a special, it's a special part of my story that I want to share with the readers at the end of the book because
No, that's fine. That's fine. Mm-hmm. Why do you think God has allowed you to live through all of this?
Well, I'm here, and I've got a voice to go out and tell my story in an effort that others who are in a position to help girls like me can hear and understand better what a girl is going through in my position. And I think that that's unique, Susan said earlier, and that possibly that's out there to help. I don't know God's plan. I really live day by day.
Mm-hmm.
And every day I just say, I got to do the next right thing. Do the next right thing, Dawn, And, always search your heart that your intentions are good. And, and that makes it clear. I mean, by doing that process, I've ended up here. So I'm so grateful, actually. Really super grateful. What a gift after going through that darkness. What a gift to be able to turn this around and say, here, to another girl, this is what I went through. It looks like yours, but I made it. You can
mm-hmm.
too.
And each story is individual. Each story has a lot of the same components in it, but
right.
each story in each case is so individual in itself. That, it's not a cookie-cutter thing where you can take one survivor and say, this is what you need to do, and you'll get better just like me.
No, you have to make suggestions, and everybody really walks their own path. There was a part, I had one counselor, too, that said, Dawn, I said, I shouldn't have drank after I made it to Asia. I feel like I just, that was, she says, Dawn, you were in a lot of pain.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't getting any other help. Maybe that was okay.
Right.
And I'm not advocating drinking, so that you're drunk, but I have to look back and I have to not have any regrets about that and think, I reached for that as a medication. I reached for it.
Right.
Did
you feel like you were blaming yourself for some of these things that happened?
It's absolutely one of the residuals. It's one of the...
Mm-hmm.
What happens? You are completely filled with guilt, shame, remorse, blame, low self-esteem. You are less than everyone around you. Everything is a big front or a big fake because you don't have a center. You don't have a core. You don't know what it's like to be anything inside. So you just, it's like mimicking life. And
mm-hmm.
everything hurts. That's what I was after coming out of abuse.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I can imagine. And I think it would be great somehow or another I keep going back to the human trafficking part of this because this
Good.
Is such a big issue.
Well,
it's becoming a huge issue because people are finally waking up and admitting that it is actually happening right here in our own backyards.
Yes.
And,
yes.
I can see that the work that you're doing is going to be definitely beneficial.
Thank you. And I want to say, too, that I am available for speaking engagements to go out and talk about my story. I am available to go out and, you know, just, you know, go to the website. I think, I don't know if this is the time to do that, but if you want to go to theroadthroughwonderland.com or search author Dawn Schiller on Facebook, you can actually link into my Facebook and Twitter accounts from the website. I have a blog where you can leave a comment, dawn-schiller.com, that I've been kind of keeping for a long time. It's really very, it's one that's kind of a logging of my journey as I write the book, and didn't even have a publisher, didn't have an agent, didn't have anything, and just was keeping the faith. And so if you want to read about keeping the faith, I think that's a pretty good kind of a, you know, internet diary that I did, and I, you know, you can leave a comment there for me if you want.
And what is the address for that again?
It's dawn-schiller.com.
Okay.
Dawn?
Yes.
You beat me to the punch. I was just going to ask you to give us some website info, and I'm going to ask you for more. But you you mentioned a few minutes ago that you hope you were making a clear case, and I just wanted to tell you, we had a comment in the chat room that you're doing an excellent job making everything clear, that the commenter said she understands everything you said, she understands the whole situation, and that she learns from you with each word you say. So a good review. And is there any other information you can give us or would like to give us about the book? For example, ordering, where it's available to order, that type of thing?
Yes, absolutely. I was talking to my publisher today, and the book is available for pre-order at Borders, and you can go to borders.com and type in either my name or The Road Through Wonderland, and it'll come up. The book will be out on August 1st, so just be aware that if you pre-order it now, it won't be mailed out until then. Like I said, that's the book part. I will also be speaking in Atlanta if you happen to be in Atlanta at the End Violence Against Women International Conference. You can go to their website. It's EVAW.com, and you can read up more. I will be one of the presenters there, and I'm very honored to do this. This is really wonderful.
And one other thing, Dawn, I'll mention this now because after saying to you, I'd like to invite you to listen in 2 weeks from tonight. Delilah is going to be one of the panelists for another show we're doing. And it's going to be about missing and exploited children. And,
absolutely, yeah.
You've talked about, you know, the throwaway teens and so forth. And perhaps if you're not busy, you'd like to, you will certainly be welcome to call in, and we can, you know, share with the audience that night also some of your experiences and so on.
Absolutely, Denny, I would love to. I would absolutely love to. You guys are great. The work that you do and your collaboration, I was introduced by a very wonderful woman, Cherry Simpson, right, who's an amazing woman. And she introduced me to you both, and I'm so grateful for it, really. I didn't know a lot about Blog Talk Radio other than Medallion Press does it with their authors. And so I didn't realize there was a good shows on about the abuse. And, you know, I know, Delilah, you do a lot with the missing, and that's just a heart-wrenching, amazing story. But I would be very honored to call in and touch base with you guys and share information and knowledge and experience with you. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome, and I think you're going to be a great asset to the program, so I'm looking forward to having you with us in 2 weeks. I'm
very
sorry,
very.
I won't take up any more of your time. We'll get back to discussing the issue at hand here. Delilah?
Oh, okay. Where do we want to go from here, Dawn?
we talked a lot this morning.
We did. But we were telling each other, well, here we are. We just did the show. We should have recorded it. But
I think I would like to, you know, one of the things we did talk about this morning that I remember is something that maybe listeners would be interested in, how I came about writing my story, to write my story. We really just jumped into it, and I don't know if everyone's familiar with the film Wonderland. It was put out by Lionsgate in 2003. It was specifically targeted around the Wonderland murders in Los Angeles, and my character was played by Kate Bosworth, who is a very sweet, wonderful, sensitive actress who I shed many tears with on the set. And I was hired on as a consultant, and then I moved to associate producer. I don't really know how that works. That's kind of Hollywood. but Val Kilmer played John, and you know, he did an amazing job. What a great method actor! I believe that's what you call it—the method style that he does. He's a Juilliard grad, and he's a great supporter of the story and my writing after the book, after the movie. But one of the things and one of the great catalysts for me to actually write my story myself was that after working on the film and telling the directors and writers about the story and bringing up the abuse, they said, all right, well, there's so many elements that we need to put into this. It's the Eddie Nash robbery. It's the Wonderland gang. It's the John Holmes and you. It's Sharon, that whole thing. And you know, he said, we'll probably only be able to put a little bit in. I said, great. What they did was they did film a part where John actually sells me to Eddie Nash for drugs. And as he brings me back to the hotel or the motel, he always beat me, and then he always bathed me in hot water. That was his ritual. What they did with the Wonderland movie was Val and Kate walked into the motel, and you could see Val's fist come down on Kate's head, you know, through the window as a silhouette. So they kept that much in. So you got, as what I thought you got was as an audience member, was you got the understanding that John was abusive physically. When I went to the premiere of the movie, they had cut that part out. So it went right from being sold to Eddie Nash to being bathed in a hot bathtub with my lips split open and my eyes black.
Like
and
he was
blue.
Taking him very good care of you.
Yeah, and he was bathing me and saying sorry, which was what he always did after the abuse. But it makes the viewer look makes them seem to think that John wasn't the one that did it. And I asked the director, I said, why did you cut that part out? That was very important. And as a victim, as a survivor, it was very important that be told. And he said, but nobody would like him if we put that on the screen.
Mm-hmm. Well, his movies are obviously still generating cash for someone.
Oh, yeah, I don't really know where it went. But, you know, I felt powerless, and I knew I was. But mm-hmm. I really felt, you know, I got a lot of support from people like Val Kilmer and Kate Bosworth, who are presently working on writing a small foreword for the book. And, you know, and they said, you should tell your story. You should tell your story. So I sat down without any experience and, you know, a GED. I'm in college now, but not much 6.5 years ago, 7 years ago now. And I sat down and I started plucking away and writing, and so I've edited and polished and edited and polished. And the reason I did it, too, is I looked at my daughter and I thought, if anything ever happens to me, and all she has is that movie that makes it look like I'm more of a happy participant than I am somebody being drugged through hell, she's going to not understand her mom. She's not going to know the truth. So I wrote it for her so that she would have the truth, and then it turned into the truth for others. And so really, it was quite an emotional process there.
I was just going to say, I'm sure it was quite therapeutic for you at the same time.
Yeah. Well, yes and no. I've had my days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the end, it was.
Yeah. You kind of have to work yourself back out of that by confronting it and facing it and knowing that it's in the past and really knowing in your mind and in your heart that it's done, it's over, and it can't be changed.
Right,
you
right.
Know, it'll always remain a part of you and who you are, but it's not something
but it doesn't
that you
define
have to
me.
Live in. No, no.
No, It doesn't define me, and I know that. And you know, and I know that if I would have had a different family, a different upbringing, and caring adults in my life would have been completely different.
Oh, yeah.
It would have been completely different. And that's the other part of what I like to present in my presentations, is to make, you know, communities accountable, to be mentors, to be those points of light for these kids who don't have anywhere else, but maybe, you know, they get to go to a community mentoring function mm-hmm. one day out of the weekend, you know, because they happen to be walking by, or their parents just dropped them off and didn't care where they were, or they went with a friend. And then when they get, so they can have, see that there are more choices in life than to relive what their past has given them.
Right, and to just be out on the street. Mm-hmm. What can you go into the peer-to-peer program that you were talking about earlier? How do you see that coming about, and how that will work?
You know what I see? I see that raising awareness with peers about the situation, you know, describing to them what a home life, a potential throwaway home life, a neglected and abused home life looks like, and just stay alert and aware, and maybe walk up and say, hey, I have, you know, to a friend that they see pulling back, or maybe cutting class, or being withdrawn, or sad, and something's up, befriend them instead of do the opposite, walk away, you know. I think that schools should develop peer counseling centers where peers go on, like after school, or maybe even a peer hotline where they can be man the phone with the supervision of, you know, a counselor in case there's a, you know, an emergency or something that's, you know, needs more adult supervising. But to be able to be there just to talk, you know, make mm-hmm. those kind of things available. You know, give these, man these teens who are on the phone line, or maybe just, you know, a walk-in like counseling center or group, or, you know, hang out after school, you know, where a teen is monitoring it. Teen panels also. Give them their own resources, you know, hook them up with the different community events that are positive mentoring opportunities, that kind of thing.
There are so many things that we need to get into the school levels, and
yeah.
you know, the funding just isn't there. You know, we hear about that all the time, and I think it's going to be up to the communities, up to the volunteers, up to the parents, the people who care, that they're going to have to somehow or another get into those schools. And it's almost now where school-age children, you have to learn so much more than just reading or writing and arithmetic and science and government and all of that. We've somehow got to teach them life.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. We have to teach them life. One of the I have a newly registered nonprofit that I'm working on, and we're, like I was telling you this morning, Delilah, we're getting
yeah.
the final paperwork together on it, and it's called ESTEAM, and it's an acronym, ESTEAM, and it stands for Empowering Successful Teens Through Education, Awareness, and Mentoring. And so through this nonprofit, what I'd like to do is be able to bring education and awareness out there, you know, visit places, visit schools, hopefully, and then give them these ideas, and then be a mentoring resource center for different areas, you know, and for different types of models that communities can emulate, they can copy, they can initiate in a small way. You know, I don't want to give people a big project. Just starting small and knowing whatever you do matters, that it doesn't have to be a huge, complicated
every little bit matters,
function.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I'm really working on that. I'm also a TTAC consultant out of the Office for Victims of Crime, and you can go in and you can, I think there's a whole list of different specialists and consultants that people can go in and they can request to come to their community through the Office for Victims of Crime that's paid for by OVC. So, you know, I just want to say that there are resources if you look for them out there, and you know, hopefully I'll be able to have more information with my nonprofit ESTEAM, and, you know,
right.
gather as many people who want to share in this voice to help these kids, these throwaways, and stop them from being trafficked and abused and homeless and, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you will have a list of all of these resources in your book, right?
Yes, I'm working on a wonderful cohesive resource page to be attached in the back of the book, and a few of the ones that I just mentioned will be in there, as well as anything else, the 1-800 Runaways, Girls Are Not For Sale. That is a wonderful, if anybody knows about that, Facebook page. These girls are amazing. These are formerly trafficked kids who believe in themselves. They're a great little team of positive young women, and I'm very proud of them, and I'm proud to be just a faceless Facebook friend to them.
Oh, that's great. I'll have to look it up.
Look it up. Yeah.
Yeah.
Dawn?
Yes.
I'd like to get the time slipping by very quickly here. I would like to ask if this question actually came from the chat room. You touched on it somewhat, talking about the peers. Specifically, can family or close, real tight friends do to help a victim get out of an abusive relationship?
Yeah, you know what? When somebody is definitely in an abusive relationship, you have to be really careful stepping in. I'm going to tell you that just by working the hotline at the shelters. You know, it can be dangerous. So you want to definitely always be safe. I would try to call my local resources and ask them before you approach somebody, if they're somebody that you go to school with, just say, hey, look, are you okay? If you need to talk, I'm here to talk. If you want me to call somebody for you, I can call someone for you. Let them know they're not alone. And you know what's really important? Document the things that you see. If you see your friend or, a peer sees another kid come in and they see the abuse, if they see the bruises, document it, because in the end that's going to be a really strong resource for this person if they can ever find the way out. Again, I would look locally to what your community offers as solid resources. I would listen to their counseling. You can speak anonymously on a lot of, hotline numbers. They don't ask who you are, and they're not supposed to pressure you for it. So gather all your ducats before you go out and step out. Because it can be a dangerous situation. Abuse is not funny. It's dangerous. It's deadly.
Let me, something else from the chat room from Valiant Press.
Okay.
The comment is, if anyone listening works with the school district and would like to be having Dawn as a guest speaker to high school students, feel free to contact me at Paul, P-A-U-L, at Medallion, Medallion Press, Press, one word, medallionpress.com. So if anyone listening now or through the archives would be interested in having Dawn at their school, contact Paul at medallionpress.com.
Awesome. Thank you very much. Thanks. See, Medallion's listening. They're amazing.
I guess so. They're here. They're right in the chat room. That's wonderful.
Oh, they are amazing. I would recommend everybody just go to medallionpress.com and go through and look at all the wonderful sponsorship that they do and, share your thoughts, ideas, whatever with them. They, great people. I really believe that was a God thing for me that, the road to getting this book published and everything was kind of very up and down, and the Medallion Press ended up being my publisher. It was truly God working through everything, and that's just what I believe. Thank you.
And one last thing, Susan just posted another resource number, 1-800-799-SAFE. That's 1-800-799-SAFE. And we just got a message, I'll read it, from Medallion Press. We love you, Dawn.
I love you guys, too. we have a lot of really good faith that this book is going to be received, by the public at a time when I think our communities are ready to listen to what our kids are going through. Like I said, John was just a conduit, or what Susan said, he was just a conduit, and I've been given the strength to tell this story as a representative for other young girls.
And you're doing a great job of it, too.
Thank you. Thank you. And you guys and your work are wonderful, too. Amazing.
Well, we'll all have to get together sometime.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
It will. We will.
Ladies, we have our last few seconds. I want to thank Delilah for being with me again tonight, and certainly to Dawn for being on with us and then telling us her story. And
thank you.
All the listeners and the folks in the chat room, thank you so much for helping the Griffin Chronicles get off to on a good footing. And don't forget, 2 weeks from tonight, it'll be February 3rd, we're doing the show on missing and exploited children, and hopefully you'll join us again then, and certainly Dawn, you also.
Absolutely.
And Susan is going to have a show on Blog Talk Radio on February 10th that we'd like people to listen into. So
we'd like Dawn to, I think Susan was inviting Dawn to be a guest on her show on February 10th. I can call
you
and we can discuss that.
Absolutely, Delilah. Okay. You guys rock.
Oh, good. Great. I'm glad you think so. I've enjoyed it. I've enjoyed meeting you. I've enjoyed the whole show. It's been great.
Thank you. And I'm really glad that I want to thank you again for your compliments on my book and my writing. That meant a lot to me. And I don't, yeah.
It's good stuff, and I highly recommend everyone. You know, it's a ride that is just unbelievable. And I'm so happy to know you on the other side.
Thank you so much. All right.
Everybody,
good night.
Okay, good night.
The air.
Do we hang up now? Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, it's 7 o'clock. That's what my clock says. 7:01. All right.
I think we're done.
Good night, ladies.
All right.
Good night, Denny.
Thank you. I'll talk to you soon, Dawn.
Okay. Thanks, Delilah. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.